wait a minute. Wait a minute. You ain't heard nothing yet.
All right, Mr. DeMille, I'm ready for my close-up.
I should come up sometime, see me.
Aiden Barr! Top of the world!
Fasten your seatbelts. It's going to be a bumpy night, sir.
The stuff that dreams are made of.
Hey everybody, Kirk here. I just want to say before we start the episode, make sure you follow us on Twitter.
And Facebook.
And if you enjoy the episode, make sure to leave us a rating and a comment on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
We love to hear your feedback, and you can find us on any social media by searching Silver Screen Time Machine.
We appreciate your feedback. Look forward to hearing from you.
Hi, and welcome again to Silver Screen Time Machine, Wendy and Kirk's classic film review. Hi, Kirk.
Hello, Wendy. How are you today?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm excited for today's episode.
And we have actually our Silver Scream Time Machine.
It is the Silver Scream Time Machine. This is our final episode.
Yep.
We're finishing up our spooky season series. And what kind of Pittsburghers would we be if we did not include in our retrospective of classic horror films, 1968, George Romero's classic, Night of the Living Dead?
Absolutely. A perfect cult Pittsburgh classic.
Absolutely.
To finish with.
Our birthright.
Right before Halloween.
Yes.
And even more exciting, not only are we talking about this wonderful Pittsburgh film, we have an actual member from the cast and producer of Night of the Living Dead, Russ Striner. Hello, Russ.
Hi, how is everyone? I'm so glad to be with you right in the Halloween season.
Yeah, absolutely. So excited to have you today, Russ. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much. So let's get started. I'd love to hear a little bit about you, your background, what you're doing with the Pittsburgh Film Office. Do you want to talk a little bit about the Pittsburgh Film Office to start out?
Sure. The Pittsburgh Film Office is the economic development agency that I had the good fortune to found in 1990. The purpose of the film office was and still is to attract movie production, movie and TV series production to the Pittsburgh region. And I'm very, very happy to say that since we started promoting Pittsburgh as a place to make films and produce films, we have managed to attract over 200 productions, that's feature films, TV series, individual TV shows, just over 200, and that has had an economic impact on the region. When those budgets do their filming here, just approaching right now $2.5 billion worth of production. When we first started, IATSE, Stagehands Local 489, I believe had 39 members. They now have, I believe it's just over 600 members now. And what that means is that there are approximately 600 people who are working full-time in the film business, making their livings, buying houses, educating their children in the Pittsburgh region.
Awesome. That's really great. I think that you've brought so much economy to Pittsburgh. And I don't think that people are very aware of that. I don't think that people recognize that Pittsburgh film means that this is an economy for Pittsburgh.
Absolutely.
I don't think they put the two and two together.
That big, yeah.
So that's awesome, Russ. We really appreciate what you've done for Pittsburgh in your whole long career.
And I got to say thank you personally, because I know I'm constantly bragging to all my non-Pittsburgher friends about all the movies. You know, they watch a movie here and I'm like, oh, that's what's filmed in Pittsburgh. That was filmed in Pittsburgh. When people come to town, I take them to all the different locations, and it's very exciting. So thank you, Russ, for putting us on the map that way.
Back in the day of Night of the Living Dead, when we said we were going to make a feature film in Pittsburgh, people literally laughed at us. It's out of our minds, and made jokes like Hollywood on the Mon and that kind of thing. Well, we just passed October 1st, the 55th anniversary of Night of the Living Dead being in commercial distribution. And I could not be more proud of the fact that its popularity is probably as strong now as it has ever been.
Yeah, so let's talk a little bit about Night of the Living Dead. I want to start out kind of at the beginning, if you don't mind, Russ. I'd like to know, how did you get together with George Romero and John Russo? How did you come together?
We are talking now 1957, 58. 59. George Romero lived in the Bronx in New York, and he came to Pittsburgh to go to then Carnegie Tech, now Carnegie Mellon University, as a painting and design major.
Wow.
I was going to night school at the then Pittsburgh Playhouse, which was an individual community theater, a very popular United States community theater here in Pittsburgh. I was taking acting lessons at night. I worked during the day, and it was during that period that a mutual friend of George's and mine, a fellow by the name of Rudy Ritchie, was taking painting and design classes with George at Carnegie Tech. But Rudy was also acting in live stage shows, and that's where I met him. He and I shared a dressing room in a production at the Pittsburgh Playhouse, and Rudy said, there's a fellow who has moved here from New York. You should really meet him, a friend of mine, George Romero. About 3 or 4 months later, I actually met George, and we struck up a friendship, and that friendship lasted 60 years.
That's amazing. And so, Russ, what did you guys do one day? You were all sitting around and you're like, hey, let's make a movie.
Well, George had a project that he asked me to act in, a project called Expostulation, which was a series of vignettes. And I agreed. I didn't know anything about film acting at all. And George asked me if I would be an actor in one of these episodes. And I said, sure, I will. And we got together. And the first day of filming for me on Expostulation, I became hooked on the whole production process. Eventually, this is now cut ahead to the early 60s, George and I were saying, well, we've got to do something to keep groceries on the table. What the heck are we going to do to keep ourselves alive? And we decided to open a film production company, which we did, called The Late Image. We developed a pretty good reputation for being able to deliver the goods as far as business films, TV commercials, industrial films, documentaries, that kind of thing.
And Russ, this film that you decided to wind up doing, Night of the Living Dead, I read that this was influenced by the novel I Am Legend and possibly Carnival of Souls. Is that where George got the inspiration and John got inspiration for this film?
The short answer is yes. Not so much Carnival of Souls, but I Am Legend, definitely yes. And that idea was rolling around in George's mind for quite a while. And it wasn't until, I'm going to say, 1966, where either George or John Russo started to put ideas on paper. So in 66, George started with, as I recall, probably about 15 or 18 pages of a script, but his script ideas meandered a little bit, talking about maybe these should be aliens coming, and you know, that involved all kinds of special effects that we couldn't really pull off with the time and budget that we had at that time. And it was John Russo who suggested perhaps these are recently dead people coming back to life. Okay, why are they coming back to life? Well, we don't know the answer to that just yet. And then it was Russo who thought maybe these recently dead people should have a flesh lust for those who are living. And that is when the idea really kicked off. Okay, these are recently dead people coming back to life, and they are seeking living victims. And that's when the idea really started to take shape. And then everyone was throwing in what if scenarios. What if this happened? What if that happened? And then it was George's and John Russo's responsibility to actually do the script. And that's what they came up with. And then once the script was pretty well outlined, we started to put together the business plan as to how we would actually pull the film off.
One of the things I love about the movie, Russ, is that you look at the iconic horror creatures that exist in our culture. Vampires, Frankenstein, Wolfman. These are concepts that have existed for centuries. And here you guys are in the late 60s and you create a brand new monster mythos. Was that your intention? Like, what did it feel like to be coming up with something completely new like that to kind of, you didn't know at the time, but that would eventually kind of seep into the popular culture the way it did?
The way it actually happened, Night of the Living Dead was self-financed. What that means is we financed the film ourselves, along with ourselves, family, friends. And because of that, it created a little bit of a financial hardship, but the freedom that it created was the fact that we had no corporate structure, no suits, so to speak, looking over our shoulders saying, well, you can't do this, you can do that. We had complete creative freedom. Now, at that time, Chiller Theater on Channel 11, Chilly Billy's Chiller Theater, was quite popular in Pittsburgh for Saturday night, 11:30 horror films, old classic horror films, more recent films. And as we watched what was showing up on television, it was our probably ego-driven consensus that if we can't do something that is at least as good as the new so-called scary films, if we can't do something that is at least that good, and that TV station decided that they would buy this particular film or package of films, if we can't match that, we might as well stick to making industrial films and commercials. That's what drove us. That coupled with the fact that we had classic films dangled in front of us, like the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, mm-hmm. Psycho. Yeah. So we knew what audiences were buying into. We knew that. And so what we had to do is use our wits and imagination to say, okay, now we're on to something. Now let's take that concept, because we have the creative freedom to do with it whatever we want, and do the best film that we can possibly do. And the result of that was the original 1968 Night of the Living Dead.
Awesome.
So, Russ, whenever you first started out and you were putting this idea together, you kind of partnered with another production company, Hardman Associates, and that was Carl Hardman and Marilyn Eastman. And they kind of partnered with you to make this film, and you created a production company called Image 10. And that's kind of how you also helped get more of a budget, if I'm not mistaken. Is that correct?
That's correct. Hardman Eastman, or at that time, it was Hardman and Associates. And Carl was one of the main characters on the Reege Kordick morning radio program. I don't know if many of the people who are following your podcast are old enough to reach back into the early 60s, but Reege Kordick was classified as a disc jockey. However, he was the most popular disc jockey in the country.
Wow.
And what made him so popular was not his spinning of records. Kordick and Company, his radio show was interrupted by an insane group of crazy people who would allegedly just wander into his radio program. And those characters became so popular in Pittsburgh. That show was outrageously popular, but Carl Hardman was one of those characters. Bob Trow supplied several of those characters, as did Sterling Yates and a few other people. And so Carl Hardman had a reputation in audio production, a similar kind of reputation that Leighton Image had in film production. Mm-hmm. And so we needed additional investors to pull Night of the Living Dead together. So we approached Carl and Marilyn and said, here's what we've got in mind. Are you interested in joining up? And they were. And where the name Image 10 came from, there were 10 of us, original investors, and we just adopted the name Image 10, and that corporation still exists today.
Oh, okay. And also, when people came on, like Carl Hardman, they kind of also got put into the film. Like, we also need actors, so we're just going to throw you in the film, too, while we're at it. And Carl Hardman does play Harry Cooper, which is a major actor in the film, and Marilyn plays the wife, Helen Cooper. And even their daughter played a role. She played the child, correct?
Ira was Carl's daughter. Marilyn is not Kyra's mother. But yes, so in addition to helping bring in investors, the Hardman Eastman group also brought in personalities into Night of the Living Dead. And other than themselves, probably the most notable one was Chuck Craig, the fellow who did all of the TV reporting in Night of the Living Dead. It was all of his TV reports that were keeping the audience up to date with what is going on with this insane proposition where recently dead people are coming back and attacking living people.
Russ, did they also bring over Judith O'Day? Did she come through them too?
Judith O'Day and myself were in at least one show together at the Pittsburgh Playhouse in a musical called Leave It to Jane. She was in the female chorus, I was in the male chorus. So I knew and worked with Judith O'Day, but she was very, very active with Carl and Marilyn with the industrial shows that they were putting on. So when it came time to start casting people, Judy O'Day had just moved off to Los Angeles to make her mark. And Carl got in touch with her and said, hey, we're getting together with a couple of people that you may know from Pittsburgh, and we're going to take a shot at making a movie. And if you would like, come on back and audition. She did, and she ended up being our Barbara.
And they kind of changed the character a bit for her, didn't they? Did they change the character from, I thought she was supposed to be more of a tough, strong leading woman, and they kind of changed the character around, is that correct?
No, that's in the 1990 remake, which George, John Russo, and myself got together to remake the 1990 remake. And we realized at that time that in 1990, Barbara could not be portrayed in the same way. Otherwise, no woman would ever speak to us again. So, in 1990, the Barbara character evolved to be a much tougher, independent woman.
Okay. Would you mind if we just talk real quick about the plot for a little bit, Russ?
Sure.
Okay. So the movie kind of starts out, actually, you're right in the beginning of the movie. You're the first character we see. You're driving in this car to a graveyard. Barbara, that's your sister. You and Barbara, you're playing Johnny. You're in this car. You're coming to a graveyard to put some decorations on. I think it's your father's, supposed to be your father's grave.
Mother's grave.
Okay. You're doing this sort of thing where you're trying to scare Barbara for whatever reason. And you do this voice that I guess everybody really loves to imitate. They're coming for you, Barbara, type voice. What? First of all, did you sort of just do that voice on your own? Or was there something that you thought about when you did that voice? Or was that just what you pulled out?
Well, the line was written slightly differently. But as background, Johnny's sole purpose at that time was just to introduce two characters, and he being the annoying brother, which was done on purpose. So by teasing her and taunting her, and Johnny was, let's face it, he was kind of a whiner and a complainer. But as part of the taunting of his sister, when I changed the line up slightly from what it was written to make it more immediate, because we had caught glimpse of an old person staggering through the cemetery. You don't know who it is or what it is or anything. And as part of his taunting, it just occurred to me that he would say something like, "They're coming to get you, Barbara." And that gave her something to play off of, that it's an embarrassment to her, which it turns out only moments later that this guy was up to no good.
This line, whenever you see a compilation of either great horror movies or great movie lines, you're always there. So for somebody, especially like you, who spent most of their career behind the camera, what is it like to know that you're kind of instilled in movie history forever with that one line?
It's actually pretty flattering, but by the same token, it's kind of surreal. Not only me and Johnny wore all the hats that we had to wear during the production, everybody did. Everyone was either making sandwiches or doing film tasks or whatever. So we didn't have a whole lot of chance or opportunity to allow our egos to get involved in.
Sure.
We were just all working on the same premise, that we just wanted to do something good. And as it evolved, as the story points evolve, Night of the Living Dead, for all of its success, is one of those films that from the very beginning scene, gradually over an hour and a half, takes things away from people, from the audience. Things that were unexpected. First of all, you expect the way they're presented that Johnny and Barbara are going to be with you for a while. Well, Johnny is there for about 8 minutes, period, and he's boom, gone. As well as a menace is set loose. Nobody knows how or why or whatever, and traumatizes Barbara to the point of catatonia.
Yeah.
And if you take a look at the story points of Night of the Living Dead, it gradually takes things away from you, from the telephone and outside communication, and aha, there's a television set. Oh, that part's good. Then the electric goes out.
Mm-hmm.
Johnny comes back and takes Barbara away in a way the audience never expected.
Because this film is obviously low budget. You didn't have a lot of money, but you put a lot of careful details in. And I want you to tell us about why you wore those gloves in the beginning.
If you're using a role model like Psycho or the original Invasion of the Body Snatchers, something like that, and you don't have much money, you better use your wits and imagination. So the reason for Johnny making such a big deal out of the driving gloves at the beginning of the film is I wanted to give Johnny a wardrobe signature that when you see him much later in the film, the audience, he's only been referred to by a catatonic Barbara. We have to get to Johnny. Johnny has the keys, this and that, the other thing. But the audience hasn't seen Johnny for quite some time. And I knew that when Johnny reappeared later in the film, he was going to be without glasses, face looking different, surrounded by other dead things. And I wanted to give him a signature wardrobe that as soon as that hand came up on the white door frame with a black driving glove, the audience instantly knew, uh-oh, that's Johnny, but not the way Barbara was hoping to get reconnected with Johnny.
Yeah, I thought that was really great. And back to the story, when you first see this guy in the graveyard, played by Bill Hinsman, you just think it's this weird guy, and then suddenly it becomes very apparent that this guy, there's something wrong with him. He's walking very strangely. I read that possible that Bill Hinsman modeled his walk after Boris Karloff. Is that correct?
I think that was indeed part of his methodology. Bill Hinsman was not an actor. He was a friend of ours who was a still photographer.
Mm.
But when it came to casting, he was tall enough, he was gangly enough, he had a distinct enough looking face that we thought, aha, maybe Bill Hinsman should be our very, very first zombie. Oh, we didn't call them zombies, we called them ghouls. Yeah.
Yeah, and actually, he does the still pictures at the end. There's several at the very, very end. They just show a bunch of still pictures over the end credits, and he did do those pictures. And I actually think those pictures are really awesome. That's one of my favorite parts.
Yes, Bill took production stills. Carl Hardman took very many of the production stills. And I'm so glad they did, because we now have those still images. Image 10 has those still images that are very useful for recreating the sense, the feel, the style of the film.
And it's so interesting how another instance of something that just grabbed the photographer because he looks the part. And now that is, you know, I go to movie theaters across the country. I see they have murals painted, and you see Bill on there as the zombie. You know, one of the most iconic images now in horror movies. So just crazy how it just came up so organically.
After the scene with the graveyard, now unfortunately, this fellow comes up and starts to attack Barbara. Johnny comes to try to defend his sister. Very, very nice. And he knocks Johnny down and he hits his head on the tombstone. Barbara flees away. She manages to get away. She gets to this farmhouse. Okay. So she shows up in this farmhouse. She doesn't know what to do. She's panicking. And then she runs into this other fellow. This other fellow winds up coming in. His name is Ben. And this is our lead character. I would love to have you talk really briefly about Dwayne Jones. And how did you happen to cast him?
Dwayne Jones was an actor from a suburb here in Pittsburgh, Duquesne, PA.
Yep.
But we didn't know Dwayne. None of our group knew him. Dwayne moved off to look for a career in acting and teaching acting in New York. A mutual friend of ours in New York, Betty Ellen Haughey, knew Dwayne in New York. And in 1967, Dwayne was coming back to Pittsburgh to visit his family on Easter weekend. And Betty Ellen Haughey made arrangements that when Dwayne came back to Pittsburgh on Easter Sunday to visit his family, that we would audition him that weekend for the character of Ben. Originally, the Ben character was supposed to be played by our longtime friend, Rudy Ritchie, the guy that I shared the dressing room with. And the character was written as a kind of a roughneck truck driver. And when Dwayne read, when he did his audition, it was pretty clear that he was not a roughneck truck driver. He was more genteel, more thoughtful, more genteel in every respect. None of the lines in the script were altered to accommodate that character, other than tweaking here and there that Dwayne would do to match that character. But he was the best person who auditioned for it. Even Rudy Ritchie voted that Dwayne should be our Ben, and we cast him that weekend.
Yeah, and that was kind of a pioneering thing to do, because at that point, there weren't a lot of Black men getting leading roles in 1967, 1968. That was not very common. So another thing that you did that was kind of pioneering, obviously you weren't doing it to be pioneering. He's really great in the role. As a matter of fact, I think he carries the film. I think he's phenomenal. But doing something like that and being a little more pioneering about choosing actors with diversity.
Yeah, but Dwayne got that part purely on his own.
Right.
Through his credentials and his audition. We would have made a great strategic blunder if we had not given the role to him, because his performance of Ben was exactly what that character needed to be. A gruff truck driver, in retrospect, when you look at that kind of character squared against Carl Hardman as Harry Cooper, would not have worked. Here you have a more genteel man of color, and that difference made all of the difference. In where you talk about conflict and so forth, those two characters locking heads fit the bill exactly.
Let me ask you this, Russ. You mentioned that there was no statement in the cast of Dwayne. He was the best actor, but a lot of it has been read into that. As well as the politics in the movie in general, there's a lot of ideas out there, a lot of assumptions, a lot of theories. What were your, you know, did you guys set out to make a political film? Or is that something just kind of built up around it?
That built up around it. As a matter of fact, Dwayne himself was more sensitized to what he was being asked to do. Once we cast him, he created the guardrails. He said, "Are you guys sure you know what you're getting into when you cast me? Remember that I'm going to be holed up in a house with all white people early on in the film. An out of control, I'd slap a white woman." He said, "You're starting to play with fire." He was much more sensitive to that than we were. However, once we saw what he was talking about from his perspective, we knew that it was highly likely that parts of the United States would not be interested in this film, primarily the red southern states. But even that political view came around, and I don't know what else to say about it, but 55 years later, Night of the Living is still around.
Sure.
And well, I think you made a great decision there. He was perfect for the role. Back to how they're trapped in this house, and then there's obviously these creatures, they call them things, outside threatening them. They're trying to break in. They have to try to secure the house. Barbara isn't very helpful because she is in a catatonic state. And Ben is trying to really hard to secure the house. And then they find out that there's some other folks in the basement who come up. And that's when we get introduced to Cooper, who turns out to be kind of a real jerk. He's a very unpleasant fellow. And I think that Carl Hardman did a really good job of playing him. It's just very cowardly, unpleasant. Yeah. And you would just couldn't stand him in the film. It just goes on from there, basically. They're all holed up in this house. They're trying to fight the creatures, trying to survive. There's a whole thing about the news. It's on the news. It's worldwide and all this stuff. But that's basically how the plot goes on. And they try different things to get out of the house, to get to safe houses, and it doesn't work, and et cetera. But that's basically the crux of the plot, I would say, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
What I really like about the film, and I thought this was really interesting, Russ, is I like the music in the film. I think it really does a good job of giving you that sort of dread feeling. Is it true that that was mostly stock music?
It was not mostly stock music. It was all stock music. And it happened to be a music library, the Capitol High Q Library, that Carl Hardman had the license for. So Carl picked out a batch of music that he thought would work. And then the compilation of that stock music score was all George Romero. He slaved over cutting the right bits and pieces of stock music to match the images that he was editing to. George shot most all of the film. I shot a little bit of it. John Russo shot a little bit of it. But George was the main cinematographer. He was also the main editor.
And we talked a little bit earlier, Russ, about how this film, very influenced by film noir with the light contrast, the dark and light, maybe some German expressionism. Can you talk a little bit about, was George Romero a big film noir fan, or he just really wanted to shoot the film to look dark?
Well, George did have a streak in him that leaned him toward film noir. But the final determining factor was we were in an abandoned farmhouse. We had very little resources in terms of all of the furnishings. Every bit of the set furnishings came from either Goodwill or items that our various families donated to the production. The farmhouse itself, I was able to make a deal with the owner of the house, Mr. Gass, and he rented the property to us and said, ordinarily when you rent a film location, the agreement is that you will leave that location in as good or better condition than you found it. Well, in the case of Night of the Living Dead, we couldn't make such a promise because we didn't know exactly what was going to happen. And I explained to Mr. Gass, we may end up setting the house on fire. And that was all okay with him because he was going to tear the house down after the filming was done. He was going to tear the house down and convert the property into a turf farm, which he did. So we were off the hook of the leave it in as good a condition or better. That clause was out the window. So we could literally do anything we wanted to the house.
We talked briefly about the TV and radio broadcasts, and I think that's one of the most brilliant aspects of the movie because you don't really know what's going on with the characters, but we get a lot of exposition. We get a lot of understanding of what's happening in the world outside of the farmhouse through the TV and through the radio. And some of my favorite scenes in the movie are the news reports, and you mentioned Chiller Theater, Bill Cardell, who hosted that show, plays one of the reporters. But there's a scene that takes place in Washington, D.C. They're interviewing some military and political figures. Did you guys actually travel to D.C. to film that?
Yes. John Russo wanted to make the story point that if we don't show something outside of southwestern Pennsylvania, that kind of creates its own claustrophobia. However, if we film a scene in Washington, D.C., that automatically opens up the storyline that this is happening everywhere. And that's exactly what we did. We piled into about four or five cars on a Sunday, one of which was Carl Hardman's Lincoln Continental, which we decorated, which they, Carl and Marilyn, decorated with some military generals' flags. And we drove down to Washington, D.C., unpacked ourselves, and filmed that scene with the Capitol. And George, in that scene, was a reporter. So I filmed the Washington, D.C. scene. We found a location where we had the right kind of angle of the Capitol and so forth. And just as we were wrapping up on a Sunday afternoon, an officer from the Capitol Police came and said, hey, you can't be here. You got to move. And we thought he was complaining about the filming. He wasn't complaining about the filming. His point was, if they allowed a general to park there, all of the generals would want to park. So you got to move on, general. And we promised him, okay, we're out of here. We're gone. And today, if we tried to do that today, we would probably still be in a holding cell under the Capitol. Because we had no permits, no anything. We just unpiled from our car and shot the film.
Well, it showed how realistic your costumes and so forth were. Absolutely. That the police actually believed that this was a real general. This film, obviously, as we said many times, made on a very low budget, but was extremely profitable, and even to this day and age is still being screened all over the place. What do you think makes this film resonate with audiences? What makes people love this film?
My own view is that it has a certain evergreen quality to it, in that today, when some tragedy happens that is reported instantly, now news is broadcast around the world about an incident happening here or there, a tragedy of some sort, the unexplained is reported instantaneously to us these days. But in all of the reporting, as the initial reports come in, no one knows for sure exactly what's happening. There's speculation and conjecture and so forth. But it takes a while before there's any hard evidence as to what's going on. And that's the way it was portrayed in Night of the Living Dead. I think it's still true today. So I think it has, that's one of the things that keeps it current. I think the black and white documentary-ness look of Night of the Living Dead also contributes to its realism. There were many, many, many lucky accidents that all came together in Night of the Living Dead, all that inured to our benefit. The way the story unfolded and the way the independence of how the film was financed and so forth, it gave us certain freedom. We didn't have a whole lot of people, studio types or suits, as they're sometimes referred to, touching all over the script points before it was actually filmed. We decided at one point, okay, we've got our own money invested in this thing. What if the ending is too down? What if distributors say, I'm sorry, this thing is just too down. No one is interested in distributing it. We thought for a very brief time, should we film a happy ending? And that only lasted for a few minutes. We decided, no, Night of the Living Dead has to end the way it ends. So we never did shoot a happy ending. We never gave a distributor the luxury of saying, well, let's edit the happy ending. So that was out of the question.
Yeah, I like the way it ends. And I'm not going to say how it ends, but I like the I like the way it ends. And I think that it wouldn't have been as artistic if you did it differently. I think that makes it more artistic. And as far as realism, I wanted to ask you a quick question. This is kind of off the subject, but I thought I heard in your podcast, do you not say that you used to have a cat named Fellini?
Yes. I didn't have the cat. George had the cat. When we first started our business at 1829 East Carson Street, which don't go looking for it because it's no longer there. It is now the outdoor portion of a restaurant. So the building is no longer there. We, thanks again to Betty Ellen Haughey, the same person who introduced us to Dwayne. She gave George a cat. So what do we call the cat? Well, let's call the cat Fellini.
Yeah.
So that was, and she also, shortly thereafter, George was always enamored of monkeys. So she gifted a Capucine monkey to George. So now we're trying to get our fledgling business off the ground, and we have two critters living as we were in our place of business. We slept in our place of business on Carson Street along with Fellini, and the monkey was just called Monkey.
I love that Fellini, though. If it's based on Fellini, Federico Fellini, then I love that.
Yes.
But he's one of my favorites, sure. Personally.
Because he was one of our heroes.
He's awesome.
We were enamored of foreign films.
Mm.
It was recently announced, and this may be something you don't want to talk about yet, or you may want to keep your feelings to yourself, and if so, I understand. But they recently announced the director for Twilight of the Dead, which is George's unfinished script. And that's going to be in production soon. Looking back on it now, the whole legacy of the movie, what do you think about George's last script going in production and finally getting made?
To be honest with you, I haven't read it. The script is the property of George's estate. And I can only assume that after being friends with George for 60 years up until the time of his death, that he would, if he was going to do another Something Dead script, he would have done it with the same care and attention and sensitivity that he did the other films, all of his other films that he wrote and directed.
Sure.
So I can only, I'm anxious to see it myself, but I have not read the script. It is the property of the of George.
Any chance of that filming in Pittsburgh?
I would hope so, but I have no insight into that at all.
Sure.
And so I think we're going to have to start wrapping up, and we really appreciate your time. But Russ, I do, this is a classic film podcast, so I do want to ask you, what is your favorite classic film or your favorite classic film genre?
They're all over the place. My probably favorite film of all time is The Adventures of Robin Hood with Errol Flynn and Olivia de Havilland. That's
really?
Probably my favorite of all time.
Cool.
However, I am still to this day a huge fan of the classic screwball comedies that came out of Hollywood. In terms of genre, I would have to say screwball comedies, and today romantic comedies, rom-coms are among my favorite as well.
Oh, interesting. That's interesting from somebody that made a horror film.
Yeah.
Unexpected.
Yeah.
Do you have any other questions, Kirk?
No, Russ, I really appreciate you taking the time. We've gone long, and I really appreciate you taking the time. It was really insightful getting to talk to you, learn all this stuff about one of my favorite movies from you.
Yeah, it was really nice of you to take the time, Russ. We really had a great time talking to you, and it was really interesting to hear your viewpoints.
Well, thank you for having me. I'm glad Halloween is right around the corner, so maybe there will be some new folks among your viewers who take a look at Night of the Living Dead with maybe a little different slant after hearing some of these stories.
Yep, absolutely. That's what we hope for.
Yeah. Before we let you go, Russ, is there anything that you're working on or anything you have coming up that you would like our audience to know about?
I am. And John Russo and I have authored a script which we are currently in discussion about with a couple of producers in Los Angeles. I am most anxious to get this project done because it is a complete, it's called Monster Flick. The undead story of how Night of the Living Dead came together.
Nice.
And it's written by two of the guys who were in the room with George. And it is filled with nuggets that you will not believe. And it also, I think, captures the flavor and the essence of the 60s with everything from political strife to the freedom movement, the assassinations, the Cuban Missile Crisis, and how all of those influences influenced us as people, and I think probably influenced some of our work as well. We're very anxious to get Monster Flick produced because it is going to be an absolute hoot.
I can't wait to see that.
That sounds great. All right. Well, thank you very much, Russ.
Thanks, Russ. Been great talking to you.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
So anyhow, Kirk, it was so lovely. Russ was just such a great guy.
That was great. It was really hard for me not to geek out over that. I tried to be professional, but the whole time, I'm like, when he did the line, oh my God, I almost fell out of my chair. That
was
great.
What a nice guy.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I love him.
Cool.
But I guess we should do our star ratings, and I kind of hope Russ isn't listening for this one.
Oh, no. Well, he can listen to mine. I'm going to give it a 5.
Oh,
this is one of my all-time favorites. Again, I might be biased because of the Pittsburgh connection, but I think it's just, I love the zombie genre in general. I love a lot of different zombie movies, but this one I still think is one of, if not the best. So yeah, I'm going 5 on this.
So we penalize films all the time for not having the technological, like our early 30s film, for example, when we talked about Public Enemy and how the cinematography just wasn't up to par, and we penalize films all the time for that. This film is low budget. It's a great cult film. I think it's great what they did. It's a great film for Pittsburgh to start Pittsburgh off. I think it's, again, it's a great horror film. But when you look at the production quality and if you're doing an overall rating with that, I can't give it anything higher than 3.
That's not bad.
So I'm sorry.
That's better than what I was expecting, to be honest.
Oh, no. Again, like I said, even though the music, obviously you could tell it wasn't done as well as it would be if you were doing a Hollywood movie, but I like the way the music reflect. It was a really good job in the music, I thought. I really liked the acting. I thought Dwayne was awesome.
Yeah.
I still have been thinking about it. So
it's definitely more than the sum of its parts.
Yeah.
It brings all those different things together that seem kind of maybe a little janky on their own, but it comes together for something great.
Yeah, and it's nice to have a sort of David versus Goliath tale on this, that this is the little film that and it did so well, and that's a wonderful story about it. So, yes. But yeah, I'm sorry.
No, it's okay. Thank you again to Russ.
Yes.
And thank you all for listening to our Silver Scream Time Machine yes. retrospective.
Our spooky season.
Back to our normally scheduled programming next week.
Yes.
But it's been a lot of fun, and we'll see you next week.
Yep. From Silver Scream Time Machine, Wendy and Kirk's classic film review. Goodbye.
Goodbye. Thank you for listening to Silver Scream Time Machine.
Be sure to follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
If you enjoyed this episode, please consider leaving a comment and review on iTunes or wherever you listen to your podcasts.
Intro music composed by Heidi Engel.
Outro music composed by Maximus Monk.
Artwork by Tyler Birch.
Produced and edited by Wendy Wittick and Kirk Kolkowski.
Recorded at PCTV Studios in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.
We'll see you next time.